Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about the movies Val and Stillwater, or what Mike and I are referring to as, you know, the classic jawline actors out there, which are Val Kilmer and Matt Damon. And just real quick, Mike, you know, in spite of the joke, you know, they really both are a certain kind of Hollywood star. So why don't we start there before we jump into Val, that they both embody this sort of Gary Cooper-esque look, which has something to do with both of their success in the movies.
That's a great way to start, because as you were saying that, I was thinking Gary Cooper. I'm thinking Hollywood film history, that strong, silent type, a man of few words and of action and so on. That's such an archetypal figure in American film and beyond. And I think with both Val Kilmer and Matt Damon, in some movies that works extremely well for them. In others, maybe it doesn't quite work as well. But essentially, as you say, Marie, it's a character, a personality type, if you will. They're not necessarily all that verbal. I mean, by that, I mean the characters they play. And so they express themselves physically, and sometimes they don't express themselves at all. The strong silent type might just be standing there. And if you're photogenic, that's not necessarily a problem.
So the movie Val is all about Val Kilmer. He does a documentary about himself using footage from movies that he shot throughout his career, footage of his childhood and home movies. So most of the film is narrated by his son, Jack, because Val Kilmer himself has survived throat cancer. Kilmer does provide some of the narration with this rasp from the two-year battle he's had with throat cancer and two tracheotomies. It's an interesting look at Hollywood within a highly personal story. What were your first reactions to the documentary, Mike?
It actually prompted me to think about his career again, because he hasn't worked much in recent years for obvious reasons. And so he's sort of like on the back burner, as they say, in terms of like, who are you thinking about? What's out in theaters and so on. And so I had to like sort of reevaluate him. And I realized, you know, I've liked some of his movies more than others, but the fact that he had a strong career going for quite a while, in terms of his physical condition, it really is haunting and daunting and all sorts of, you know, it just prompts all sorts of melancholic thoughts, because he, as that strong silent type, he really had the chiseled features. He was really handsome and really strong and all those things. And because of the illness, you know, physically the effect it had, and certainly vocally. So to hear him communicating, speaking through a tube, basically, you know, you get used to it, quote unquote, but there's always that sense of when you see older clips of him in his prime in Hollywood and see how he is now, and then we can talk some more about, you know, ramifications of that, it really does get your attention. What does work well in the film is that his son, Jack, as you say, Marie, you know, actually reads aloud some of it, you know, sort of facilitates the narration, if you will, to have the son actually read some of the quotes there. And that actually works. I mean, it's not a self-indulgent gimmick or anything like that. It just works, and it helps enhance the sense of family. Now, a minor reservation, this film makes such extensive use of archival footage. A lot of it essentially home movies shot by Val and his two brothers back in the day, and then just by Val, and you really have a visual archive that way. It does really show you the family life as much as the cinematic life. And yet my feeling is that the film ultimately is not so much a profile as in a well-rounded profile, all aspects of the career. It's more a sort of self-portrait, a memoir that way, that has advantages and disadvantages. You know, because Kilmer is so much controlling what we're watching, indeed, he's listed in the credits as a cinematographer. You don't see that very often. He's both subject and cinematographer. You know, you really have it from his perspective quite literally. And an example of how that can be a disadvantage in some ways is that he has a reputation or had a reputation for being a difficult actor on the set. A lot of stories over the years that he's difficult to work with. Maybe that explains why I wasn't working as much in some of the later years. But in any event, whatever the extent of that is, in the film, it gets mentioned, but it's kind of downplayed a bit. It gets finessed a bit that way. And so I was struck by then reviewers of the film who, in one case, one reviewer pointed out that, well, you know, it's a personal look, but not an intimate one. And I like that distinction, that you feel like he's opening up the photo album, as they used to say, but only to certain pages or only to a certain amount. I don't think you ever really get the feeling that you're deep inside him there. It's sort of like, it's like an actor controlling the narrative. He's opening it up and there's the sense of familiarity, but I think it actually stops at a certain point and doesn't go deeper. What do you think?
I agree, because it's almost like he comes on to say, you know, hi, I used to be Val Kilmer. And then what comes after is the aftermath of the the throat cancer and the tracheotomies and whatever, where you're, this is who he is now. And what will strike you when you watch it, if you watch it, is that, is there anything more cruel than taking away an actor's voice? It's just such a blow in terms of your career. I mean, where do you go from there? What it reminded me of, and I wanted to see if this struck you too, was the movie done late in his life of Roger Ebert, who had also suffered some cancer and some surgeries. And so he looked, you knew it was Roger Ebert, but he didn't look like himself. And what you're kind of witnessing is the ravages of the disease, which, you know, sort of comes with it, you know, the warning of all the things to do to avoid cancer. But that's not part of Val Kilmer's movie here. This is not about, so don't smoke so that you don't end up like me, or, and then I couldn't get any more roles in Hollywood. And, you know, but I didn't end up taking drugs. It's kind of, despite this happening to me, this is a look back at my career, which I really kind of appreciated, because everybody goes through, you know, the vagaries of the kinds of things that happen to all men. So I appreciated on that level that he didn't try to make it into some sort of treatise for how, you know, you should use his experience to do something different with your own life.
I was really struck by the comparison you made with Roger Ebert. I actually got to know Roger Ebert and his wife in the years I was going to the Telluride Film Festival in Colorado every year. And so it's what I called a once a year friendship. You sort of pick up a year later. But the years I knew him, he was really physically robust. I mean, he was still working, you know, as a critic, certainly. But, you know, he was in good health, as they say. And the physical, and for us, the visual contrast between him in his prime, you know, as a film critic, and I mean the physical appearance, and then in his later years, as documented very powerfully, actually, in that film that you're referring to about Ebert. For me, it was so haunting to watch that, because as I'm watching him in that film where he, you know, goodness knows the way he suffered with the cancer and just the toll it took physically, to see that would have anyone affected emotionally. But when you knew him back in the day and then you see him now, and that's one of the things, actually, let's jump to Val again, as we should. Even though I had reservations about the film, what really makes it work on an emotional level is constantly going from the archival clips of him, like going back to the 1980s and 90s, and, you know, whether it's a good film or a bad film, when he's young and in his prime physically, just to simply have an edit, a cut from how he looks in one of those films to how he looks now as he's talking about that earlier career. What makes it all the more haunting, actually, is now that he's, you know, essentially not working as an actor, you know, he's still making money. He's, you know, you got to put bread on the table, that thing. And so in his case, he does the obvious celebrity thing, which is, you know, he's appearing at Comic-Con conventions and, you know, all sorts of autograph sessions and this and that. And he's a trooper that way. He's really doing, you know, he enjoys meeting the fans. He likes to talk about the career and so on. But when I say sad, I just mean rather than like appearing in big budget Hollywood movies now, he is literally making his money off of his earlier work, his reputation that way. And he's on that circuit, as they say, right? He's doing the nostalgia trip. And I don't blame him whatsoever. I mean, it's an income. He enjoys it. All that, you know, Godspeed, that's terrific. But Marie, don't you think there's a kind of sadness, though, when you see him like in contemporary footage, today's footage of him at some fan convention, he's greeting the fans, signing posters and DVDs and all that. Yeah, it's really heartwarming to see him out and about and connecting with his fans. But isn't it also kind of sad that just the contrast between him back in his heyday as a movie star and now just making what money he can?
Yes, I will agree with you on that. And I think that part of that is about being brought low by, you know, the what happens to, you know, your body without your consent. So I wanted to throw two things at you. One, comparing Val Kilmer's reaction to what happened to him with Montgomery Clift, two very attractive actors who had physical things happen to them. Montgomery Clift was in a car accident and he never got over it. I mean, he was never able to, you know, get over not being Montgomery Clift, one of the most attractive men who ever lived, where Val Kilmer at least gives you a sense of, yes, what an incredible blow to an actor. And yet there's no sense of real self-pity or if only, or, you know, I just can't bring myself to do any acting because I'm not what I was. There's a humility there. And the second part of what I wanted to ask you was, it's really hard to watch him try to speak because it is just such a struggle for him. So what did you think of those two things, the Montgomery Clift thing and the watching him overcome his inability to speak without having to plug his air hole?
What a wonderful coincidence. Our audience should know that these shows are not scripted. You can probably tell. These shows are not scripted. And the wonderful coincidence is entirely by chance. Last night, Marie, and you love Alfred Hitchcock. Last night,
yes.
I was watching Hitchcock's I Confess.
Which I love stars I Confess.
Montgomery Clift is as the most attractive priest. I mean, he's incredibly handsome. He's a movie star priest, if you will. But, you know, joking aside on that, watching him in the film, there's a lot to think about when you watch that film, but watching him in the film, because of the physical beauty, there's no other way to put it. I mean, you know, such a handsome actor, to think about what would become of his career, what would happen, you know, certainly with the auto accident and other things, just how sad that can be. And one of the things I appreciated about Val, we've been referring to already, is that it does remind you of what other actors like Montgomery Clift or the film critic Roger Ebert, whatever, where physical illness takes a toll. And that can happen and does happen to everybody, of course. But then when you think about if you're someone in the public light, you're in the spotlight, man, the pressure there, you know, I'm getting at, like in anyone's life, yeah, it's going to be an overwhelming thing to confront. But when you're a movie star, when you're a public figure like that, it's that photo blown up, if you will, right? It's like, you know, the before and after, if you will. And the documentary Val, to its credit, I mean, it doesn't get exploitative about it, but it makes it clear that, you know, when you see him in films, like for me, like the real breakthrough was Top Gun in 1986. And I use it in a course I teach on Hollywood in the 1980s. I wouldn't make a claim that it's a great film, but it's what I call a zeitgeist film. It speaks to the Reagan era, if you will, in terms of American values and patriotism and strong silent types in the movies, right? You know, these macho guys who are going to defeat the communists, defeat the enemy, all that. But just watching him in that film, that's what I mean by watching him in an earlier film where he's in his prime, I mean, as an actor, and he's a genuine movie star in a film like that.
Of course, I'm glad you mentioned Top Gun because that's what most people remember. But he also played Jim Morrison in The Doors in 1991 and did all of his own singing. And of course, Batman Forever in 1995. But the movie I use in my classes is At First Sight from 1999. And I use it in a course I teach with Helen Mitchell called Film and Philosophy. And this is the movie we use that talks about how you see reality. The movie is based on a real life story about a man who was blind and then gets his sight back, but he has none of the markers that we have to understand what he is seeing. So it's a fascinating portrayal, and Val Kilmer is wonderful in it. So if you haven't seen At First Sight in 1999, go ahead and check that out, because I think that's one of his unsung, you know, hidden gems. Also, just to mention, because, you know, the name Kilmer may ring a bell for people, he is a distant cousin of Joyce Kilmer, who wrote that famous poem, I Think That I Shall Never See a Poem Lovely as a Tree. So there is a sense there with Val Kilmer's family that, you know, there's talent just sort of hidden underneath the surface, that so it's not surprising that it would come out. And what is nice about the movie is all of the personal footage, the home movies, the him talking about his experience of, you know, he stumbled into this fabulous career and for a while it went swimmingly. All of those moments, I think, make for great cinematic watching. What did you think, Mike?
Well, yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned some of his other films, because we should talk about them. You know, that was his heyday. Go back to like the, you know, from the mid 80s into the 90s. One of the highlights I thought of this particular documentary is when he talks about Batman Forever. You would think that would be like, you know, it's obviously a lot of money. It's a big paycheck and a lot of public acclaim, you know, at least recognition. But he's so funny in the film talking about, you know, it really was not a film he enjoyed making. And he mentions like the weight of the outfit you wear, and it's hot and clammy and you have trouble breathing. And no, but after a while, people can't quite hear what you're saying. They don't even talk to you. They just see this guy in an outfit going by, right? And you don't have, you know, direct communication even with the people on the set very much. You're just standing there encased in your outfit. So, you know, he made it clear that sometimes movies like that, which we watch in a kind of like bubblegum enjoyment way, right? There he is as Batman all dressed up. But it's anything but fun sometimes to be in that suit. But the other film you mentioned, which I'll declare is my favorite, I think actually his most impressive performance, is as Jim Morrison in The Doors. Because I'm, you know, I'm a fan of The Doors, and you know, I know the image of Jim Morrison and so on. And I thought he really captured that personality, and physically managed to look quite a bit like him, and, you know, to do the singing and all that. He was so persuasive in that film. And so for me, like the short, I mean, Top Gun is really what made him a movie star. He'd only been in movies a few years at that point. And then a few years after that, I thought it was The Doors that really cemented it. In terms of like big box office, you know, you get Batman Forever and so on. That's where he's really riding high. Some of his career choices after that, you could question. And then certainly once the physical illness hits, you know, enough said there. I mean, it really, you know, kind of not quite ends, but almost ends an active screen career. And the bulk of the documentary then really does spend as much or more time with those home movies to see family life, to see him today and so on. And yeah, it does open up the personal life. As we said earlier, I think there's a certain limit. I think it stops at a certain point in terms of how much opening up it'll do. But that makes it quite interesting to watch.
Now, I want to mention that I streamed this on Amazon. So anybody who's interested in this movie can actually stream it without having to try to find it in the theaters, because it did not come to a theater near me. Also want to mention, just in passing, because I don't want to get too bogged down with this, but I think it is important, that after the movie wrapped, you know, the technology to provide a AI voice that sounded just like Val Kilmer became available. And we talked about this really briefly with the Anthony Bourdain movie, that, you know, was it ethical to take things that he had said in writing, but hadn't said to someone, and use AI to make a voice that sounds like him say those words? So they did, they are able to do this. I don't know that if that would have improved the movie. I just want you to give a quick reaction to that. And also just really briefly, was this movie a good enough documentary for you to have used it in your documentary film class or to be nominated for the Oscar?
Well, you know, in terms of the ethical considerations, what you mentioned there with voicing and so on, yeah, that's a concern. But, you know, honestly, I don't think it was a major concern here. And I think the easiest way around that, without quite dodging it, but it's just simply at some point what's known as full disclosure, right? Somewhere either in the film or at least in the credits, just to indicate what you were talking about. And you can do that in a line or two, right? And then no problem at that point. And whether the audience likes that technique or doesn't, at least they know. And so I think that's always what I call the full disclosure clause, if you will. But watching the film and knowing that, it was not a vexing issue for me. You know what I mean? Now, in terms of using the film, I probably would not use it in my documentary film history course. It's so specific to that actor. If I used it in a course ever, it would have to somehow be almost like an appendage or a supplement to something else we were watching or using. Like if we were watching another film with Val Kilmer, for whatever reason, well, Top Gun, right? You know, if I'm showing Top Gun, sure, I could see maybe not showing the whole thing, maybe just an excerpt, you know, of him watching himself in Top Gun or something. I mean, it might work that way, excerpted, but I have no plans to use it. In terms of documentaries and the Academy Awards, you and I know in recent weeks, we've talked about some other documentaries. It's been a good year for documentary film. So as to whether it'll get an Oscar nomination or not, it might well. And actually, he's a, you know, for all his difficulty on the set sometimes, you know, he is a survivor, you know, quite literally in Hollywood. And that tends to get Academy Award interest, doesn't it? You know, the voters tend to acknowledge things like that. So on a sentimental note, and I don't mean this in a snide way at all, but on a sentimental note, that works in favor of the film, I would think, in terms of end of year awards recognition.
I would agree with you. And also I would say that I thought some of the scenes were really quite brave and vulnerable. So that may put him over the edge. So, you know, now we're going to segue into our second fabulous jawline, Matt Damon, and the movie Stillwater, which I have to say going into it, I was sort of dreading seeing this, if only because it goes over the 2-hour mark, which always makes me anxious that I'm going to go into some sort of sloppily edited, you know, movie that's going to be too flabby with what it's trying to include. And I want to say that, you know, Tom McCarthy is an American film director, screenwriter, and actor, and best known for The Station Agent, The Visitor, Win-Win, and Spotlight. And Spotlight in particular, I think, is the movie to compare this movie with, because it's like a well-known topic from the news and scandal. But when you kind of dig down into the storyline, it's absolutely fascinating. So the runtime didn't bother me at all. This is a fish out of water story where Matt Damon has to go to France and try to help his daughter who has been, you know, accused of a crime that she says she didn't commit. I think he is fantastic in this. And I especially loved seeing Camille Cotin in it as the French woman who helps him, because I know her pretty well from a French TV show that is on Netflix called Call My Agent, or in France, it's called DePorsant, because that's what you give your agent. She plays one of the agents in that series. It's absolutely fabulous, by the way, if you have Netflix and you haven't seen it. I really enjoyed this movie on so many levels, the script, the humor, the way it does not deify the Matt Damon character, but makes him very flawed. What were your reactions to this movie, Mike?
Well, Marie, I enjoyed the film, but not quite as much as you did.
I'm being blunt.
And here are a few of the reasons why. When you mentioned topicality, it's based very much on a real life person, Amanda Knox, a young American woman who'd gone to Italy and, without belaboring the story, gets involved in a murder case, actually is convicted. And then a long chapter by chapter story at that point in terms of everything she goes through in the courts. But anyway, you know, ultimately, you know, exonerated, you know, freed and so on. She has complained about the movie. And when you watch Stillwater, again, I'm not her advocate necessarily, but I can understand why she would complain. There are aspects of the young woman in the film that if that was based on my life, I might have some qualms, like, well, I wasn't really like that, you know, or that it didn't quite, you know. Anyway, the film, to its credit, says that it was basically, well, it doesn't really belabor the point. It's inspired by, you know, that whole thing of inspired by a true story. I mean, that's how the credit would read, like inspired by a true story. So I wouldn't sweat that, but it does have some comparisons with the Amanda Knox story and the creative team, Tom McCarthy, other people working in the film. They certainly were thinking about that. One of the reservations I had actually was along those political lines, though, because that did become a political story. This is a film that plays not exactly fast or loose with politics. You get mentions of political issues here, but you know what? It doesn't really take a firm stand. And if you look at the character played by Matt Damon, he's an Oklahoma oil rig worker, and he's a man of few words. He's got that gruff demeanor, doesn't say a whole lot, just kind of shuffles along and, you know, whatever. You know, he loves his daughter. That's not really in doubt, but he's not one to say much about that. And this is, Marie, back to one of your earlier points. This is where the film did start to not bother me, but I felt like I was marking time. That speaking of time, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes. And there are a lot of scenes where it's just Matt Damon, very much a middle-aged actor now. He's 51 and, you know, looking good for 51. But the point I'm making here is he's gotten, you know, kind of chunky and kind of, you know, it's middle-aged solid, if you will. And the face is nearly blank. And this is the character's face, not Matt Damon's. You know, the character's meant to have kind of blank expression. A little bit of that can go a long way. And there are scenes where it's just that blankness. Now, what's not being, and you could argue that that's true to the character. There are a lot of guys who are strong, silent types. They don't say much, you know, they're just gruff and go along, but they're basically good Joes, right? So, okay, I grant that. But as a moviegoer, there are scenes where I feel like, well, I'm not going to get much more out of this scene. It's just him looking blank, standing in the middle of a room, you know, and it's like, how much more of that do I need? And back to the politics, in terms of his take there, you know, when he goes overseas to try to rescue his daughter, there are a lot of issues that are kind of left hanging there as to, well, you know, politically, where is he in this? You know, there's a very quick reference to Trump made. I mean, things like that, where the film is kind of mentioning, you know, political positions, you know, along the spectrum and veering more towards the conservative end of the spectrum. But you know what? It doesn't really follow through on that stuff. It just seems like they get not nervous so much as wary. Like, well, people, you know what happens ultimately? It becomes a more conventional action thriller. And it works pretty well on that level, but it sort of shies away or backs off from being more of a political thriller. And so that bothered me a bit. And so there are some twists in the story that also bothered me a bit. When he gets over there, you know, he's in France, he's trying to, you know, he does eventually learn a little French. And to this man who speaks so few words in English, to his credit that he speaks some words in French eventually, not at first. But anyway, when he's there, when you mentioned the French actress that you like, she's quite good in this. It's the character I have reservations about. The character is an actress, you know, single mother and so on, a really good person. So I'm not making fun whatsoever. They're a really good person. But I would say almost too good a person. Can you be too good a person? Well, yes, because the story itself verges on a kind of fairy tale at that point. He's over France, very frustrated, trying to go through all the machinations of getting his daughter out of jail, whatever. And, you know, he meets and falls in love with and is living with, you know, this young French actress and her absolutely adorable daughter. And all that's great. It's swell, but it's almost too swell. You know what I'm getting at? There are times where I just felt the storytelling touch there. Not that there aren't such angels in the world, but it just seemed like it was really pushing it that way. And among other things, of course, they're going to be his salvation. I mean, that, there's that sense to it, that potentially that, you know, they're going to get him not only to learn to speak French, but to just open up a bit more. And yes, that works emotionally, but I oftentimes felt the strings being pulled, you know, like the narrative strings, the scripting strings there. And so not that it was implausible, but there were places in the film, there were entire scenes I thought were borderline implausible as to just, you know, how angelic can an angel be?
Well, you brought up great points. I think the strength of the Matt Damon character here is coming across as that good Joe, that guy who means well and is in a situation where he's completely over his head. They do try to do something with the political aspects, but I thought in a way that was done kind of deftly, in that you see how he is being judged by what he appears to be rather than what he actually is. I thought that was actually quite well done. I thought he did a really good job of sort of embodying this blue collar Oklahoma oil rig guy who all he wants to do is do right by his kid, but he has a whole life of screwing things up. In terms of it being an Amanda Knox ripoff, I followed that whole scandal and I did not, I mean, I see the basic setup, but it's not about the character who's actually been accused, who, by the way, is played by Abigail Breslin, and I thought she was fantastic in it. And I think she will be nominated for an Academy Award for that performance. But it's about how that situation plays out when you're the parent of the person who has gone through this, which I thought was a unique way of looking at it. And so that's why I wanted to give a nod to Tom McCarthy for being involved in it, where, I mean, Spotlight, who wants to watch a movie about Catholic priests abusing people? And then you watch it and it's completely absorbing because it is about that, but it's really about the human cost of all the people around, you know, and what goes into covering that kind of thing up in the first place. So I thought this was a good follow-up to something as powerful as Spotlight, because how do you follow up Spotlight? I thought taking that Amanda Knox story, if that's the source material, and making it about the parent, the flawed parent who's trying to help their kid through this terrible, maybe a miscarriage of justice in a whole other country where you don't understand it. I thought it actually did a pretty good job of that. And in terms of the characters being a little maybe too good for words, I did think it played off of that good Joe character in that, you know, you create somebody who's so believably trustable for all of their quote unquote flaws that you just can't help but sort of buy into it until you realize, oh, wow, this is actually dragging me down too. So I think in all of those respects, I think we're going to see a lot of Academy Award nominations for this movie. I think Matt Damon for sure, and Abigail Breslin. What do you think?
Abigail Breslin is very good in this film, and it's a supporting role. And to the film's credit, you know, it says it's inspired by the story of Amanda Knox. It's not really her story per se. And you're absolutely right, Marie. It's really more about the parent here. And I think that's to the credit of the film, really, that rather than just give us like a sort of biopic about Amanda Knox, no, it's really not that. It's really more about the parent. And as to, you know, award nominations, working against the film is that it hasn't really done much at the box office. There's not a whole lot of public interest or buzz that way. But people who do watch the film generally, like you, Marie, I mean, it's been a favorable response. And mine's favorable, too. I'm being a little grouchy with my response because there are a few things that you know, rankled a bit. But it's an absorbing film. It's a good film. And I wish it were shorter and tighter in various ways. And I wish, you know, Matt Damon's character would sometimes, you know, speak a full sentence. But I know not everybody's going to speak a full sentence in a movie, you know, so I just got to live with that.
Well, that brings us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to take a look at our other episodes at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com, and we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.